Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. I'm Alex Starr, the History Project Student Coordinator. Today we're interviewing Mr. Lyle Knott, QC, from the class of 1972. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a son of a pioneer family. So the family would have settled in British Columbia starting in the mid-1800s. Missionaries, engineers, physician, and a First Nations. So Scottish and First Nations by background. And but I self-identify as a Canadian. I was born in Vancouver. I've never lived more than 5 kilometers from the hospital I was born in, being the Vancouver General Hospital. I have a enormous family in Vancouver, British Columbia. My wife and I were adding them up the other day, and between the two of us, we have 48 members of our immediate family that live within walking distance of our house. So family are principally of a professional. My father was a physician, my mother a teacher, my uncle was a physician, my aunt a physician, my grandfather was a teacher, and so on. So and all in the Lower Mainland and Vancouver Island. So I went to Maple Grove, Point Grey. My grandfather was the first vice principal of Point Grey. You went to Point Grey.
Yes.
And McGee, and graduated from McGee. And then UBC for commerce and law, and then London for a master's of law. And then I practiced continuously in downtown Vancouver since 1974.
You were enrolled in the joint commerce law program at UBC.
Yeah.
Well, what drew you to this program?
Well, I always had an interest in business and law, but my interest in law was really wasn't focused. And I looked at the options as a commerce student, and if I chose the law option, I got more of a liberal arts education than I would have a straight commerce education. And that led to in those days, commerce was a 5-year degree, and with the commerce and law option, after 4 years of commerce, you would go into law, and after your first year of law, you get your commerce degree. So that seemed to be a pretty good deal, and law opens up so many doors and gives you so many options. It certainly did then, and it does today. So that on top of a commerce degree seemed like a pretty good idea. And then I got into law school and found that I was very well suited for it. And then a scholarly endeavor with a master's of law. And then came back and started practicing law. And I've been doing that ever since.
Wow.
But the commerce of law option gave me that flexibility.
Yeah. Were there many other students in the joint program, and would you study with them, or was it kind of you make your own?
Yeah, we kind of hung out together. I would say that there would have been probably 24 of us, and we were all motivated in the same way. We wanted to get a little more of a liberal arts undergraduate degree, and so we would bump into each other in history classes and English classes and so on. And then once we got to law school, we sort of integrated into the general student body. I've still got friends that went through through commerce with me.
I think that leads into sort of the next question of, do you remember any of your specific classmates from law school? Any?
Oh, I have very close friends. In fact, some of my closest friends today are my law school buddies from late 60s, early 70s. So Hein Paulus,
Steichmann.
Steichmann's. He was the top student in first year, second year, and he was number two in third year. Oh. And in those days, the gold medal was awarded to the top student in third year. So he was kind of cheated out of the gold medal.
Wow.
But he was okay with that. Very bright student. Chris Pollard is another one. And Chris and I are today very close friends. And I see a lot of him. He's retired. But in the early years, he was practicing at Bullhauser. And I was at Ladner Downs. And both of us had an ambition to hang out our shingle. And so we formed the firm of Knott, Pollard & Morgan. And we did that for 5 years. And very successful, had a great commercial practice. Both of us had a very good network, young lawyers who were building a practice. And so we built that firm through 12, 13, 14 lawyers. And at that point, we were starting to attract clients that needed more than we had to offer. We didn't have a tax lawyer. We didn't have an intellectual property lawyer. We didn't have a labor lawyer. And we needed those. And it was, and that issue kind of was growing. It was becoming a bigger issue as we got more clients and enjoyed considerable success. And so we could have tried to build from the inside, or we could join another firm. And at that point, Clark Wilson was going through some major changes. The founders had pretty well all died off, and the firm was going through some internal changes, and it presented a great opportunity for all of us to get together. And so I joined, and then Chris joined, and Bernard Pinsky joined, and Don Sahota joined.
Wow.
So Chris and I are great old friends. Ron Stern is another classmate that I see a lot of. And Ron is probably one of the most successful business people in British Columbia today. I don't know whether you may have heard his name. He's a big supporter of the law school, but anonymously. But a guy who is, as a practicing lawyer, he was just outstanding.
Oh, excellent.
And did more business along with his legal practice until the business opportunities outgrew the legal practice. He has enjoyed an incredible career as a businessman. Owns assets, owns pulp mills, paper mills. He owns the Winnipeg Free Press. He owns some retail outlets, some chains. He's heavily into the clothing business, manufactures jeans and bathing suits. And
he has
in downtown Vancouver, he would be one of the biggest players in this province.
Yeah.
And a well-kept secret. Anyway, he's a great friend of mine. John Zazerny is another one who I keep in touch with, and John and I did our master's together. We both went to London, and we were UBC together, and then both went to London, and he came back, and he was a native Calgarian, so he went back to Calgary, and always had an interest in politics, and so he ran provincially and was elected.
Excellent.
And Peter Lougheed was the premier at the time and chose John as his minister of energy. And John, in that government at that time, that was the second most powerful position, and he was being groomed to take over from Lougheed and chose not to.
Yeah.
Just didn't want to make a career out of politics. So he went back into law and joined McCarthy Tetro. But really, for the last probably 15 or 20 years, he's been a professional director. And he spends time in Calgary, he spends time here. Very successful career in politics, business, and law. So I see a lot of him. professors.
Any specific professors?
Well, Dennis Pavlich wasn't there when I was there, but he is a friend.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of legal work for UBC. He was the counsel when I was sort of first started doing legal work at UBC. So he and I worked together as a solicitor and client. And then he went back to the law school, got to know him personally quite well, his family, and his son is a brilliant lawyer. He practiced here for a while. And then he was enticed to go off to the Big Apple, and he is now a senior partner in one of the big firms in Manhattan.
Wow.
And the daughter has chosen a career in politics. Not elected politics, but she's served
behind the scenes
as ministerial aide in the Harper government and in the Campbell government, and a bright woman, bright woman, very involved in the community. The profs that I remember, George Curtis, of course, was the dean, and I knew him quite well. There was a family connection there. His daughter and my sister were great friends. Joe Smith, Peter Burns, Bertie McLean. McLean, I thought, was the best teacher I ever had. He was outstanding. And then the librarian, Tom Shorthouse. He was my grade 8 teacher at Point Grey. And then he went back to school and became a librarian and specialized in law libraries. And the next thing I know, I walked in day one, there was Mr. Shorthouse, my grade teacher. So he was very helpful and a really good guy. And he was out there for a long time. Pure Canucks fan, his son is the voice of the Vancouver Canucks. I haven't seen any of these guys. I see, I call him Professor McLean. Occasionally, he was downtown. I think he was at the old Russell Dumoulin Faskins for a while. He was sort of associate counsel.
Yeah.
So I would bump into him occasionally.
Thinking more about your time in law school and less about people, were there any significant traditions that you participated in?
When I started law school, that would be 1969. That's a long time ago. The facility was the old law library, and then a bunch of classrooms that were left over from the Second World War. These huts.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't really the same sense of the school as there is today. So the trike races started, and everybody got involved in that. Intramural sports, within the faculty, we had various football teams and things like that. I kind of played around with that. The experience of those buildings is interesting because they literally were built during the Second World War as temporary huts. And one of the buildings had a heating issue, and the heat would come in through the radiators, and the radiators would start to shake. You know, the prof is at the front of the class, and the radiators are just clang, 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 clang. And that was, I mean, it was like all the time. It wasn't like every now and then. It was, you know, as soon as things got a little cool and the heat was turned on in the rooms, you had this constant noise. So the facility was very, very, very different. Things like legal aid started. I think it was sort of my contemporaries that got together and started a legal aid program on campus. And then various organizations, and I remember there was one on the east side of Vancouver called Frog Hollow. It's still there. It's sort of like a neighborhood house.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, I'm going back a long time in my memory now, but I believe that that was the first sort of law school legal aid program off campus.
Oh, wow.
And Hein Paulus and I
yeah.
Participated in that as sort of from the law school.
Yeah.
And then from that, the program developed and developed and developed. And so it's changed a lot.
Wow. You mentioned before, and sort of telling us about yourself, that you have an Aboriginal background and Aboriginal heritage, and you're a citizen of the Métis Nation. Was there an attitude towards Métis people during your time at law school, or just the general attitude towards Indigenous and Métis rights at the time?
Well, I personally don't self-identify.
Yeah.
I'm a Canadian, and so I don't want to say I don't play the race card,
but, yeah,
you know, I don't. And so if you know me, you know that my background, and certainly at law school, my grandmother was still alive and very much part of my life. And so my friends would meet my grandmother, and she's very Indian.
Wow, okay, yeah.
And so, you know, everybody kind of knew that I was part Indian, but, you know, it wasn't something that I wore on my sleeve, and I didn't dine out on it. Mm-hmm. The awareness at that time of the whole issue of First Nations and the history and so on, the awareness level was just about zero.
Yeah.
You know, a Métis, you know, if you said you're a Métis, well, that kind of meant Louis Riel, and so you were part French, part Indian.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't French, I was part Scottish and part Indian. And so Métis had a different connotation. And then just people didn't think about it. You know, the Indian reserves that are around Vancouver, the one the closest was Musqueam, which was, you know, it's a stone's throw from the center of campus.
Yeah.
And there was no connection. It was like they didn't exist. And, you know, it wasn't much in the way of animosity. It just wasn't on the radar screen. And, you know, summer jobs, you know, my classmates would go off. Maybe they'd work in the bush or, you know, do something like that. And they'd interface with First Nations Indians, as my grandmother called herself, proudly.
Yeah.
And so they would interface with Indians, and, you know, by and large, they were not an educated people, and they had substance abuse problems and all the social issues. I mean, they were all there. And so you sort of come back to school, and your impression of these people was not good.
Yeah.
But that was about it. You know, there just wasn't, it wasn't on the radar screen.
Yeah, that's
cool. I've become very popular. Enough things are sort of like, oh, we need somebody with an Aboriginal background. Do you know anybody?
Right.
And Lyle, you know, he's. And I can remember serving on the International Joint Commission, and the commission got this sort of questionnaire from the Government of Canada saying, you know, what's your Aboriginal representation? And there were only three Canadian commissioners.
Yeah.
And who on your staff and so on. And it's like, nobody.
Oh.
And I said, well, that's not true. You know, I'm a Métis.
Yeah.
And I'm a registered Métis. So it was like, oh my God, you know, like, great. So, you know, if I wanted to play that card, I could certainly, you know, there would be doors that would open to me, but I've got lots of doors that are open to me, and I don't need any more, but, you know, I'm glad to help. I'm certainly proud of my background, and it certainly is something today that's quite politically correct.
Yeah. I mean, you said your classmates had these interfaces from the summer. We'd come back with this negative impression, but sort of there also wasn't the awareness of sort of the issues.
No.
Yeah.
So we had a couple of Indian guys in the class, guys. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing about the class of 72. There were like virtually maybe out of 200 people in the class, there may have been 15 or 20 women.
Okay.
There were probably three or four Indian guys. Bill Wilson was in our class. But he was just another student, and, you know, nice guy, and mm-hmm. one of my classmates. And no one sort of singled anybody out as, well, you're in Indian, and so, you know, it's different. I don't think he got any breaks.
Yeah.
He was just treated like everybody else.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Now asking about your master's at the University of London, what was it like studying in the UK?
Well, I would encourage any student who wants to do postgraduate work to do so.
Okay.
It was an experience of a lifetime. I looked at which universities I would like to attend, and, you know, all the big ones, and Cambridge and Oxford and Harvard and Yale and so on, and decided on London. Because of the courses that were offered principally, and it was, in those days, it was an intercollegiate degree. So you could attend classes at University College, at London School of Economics, at King's College,
oh, wow.
at Queen Mary College. So you could get the best, you know, professor in the world who happened to be at LSE for company law, which I did.
Amazing.
Professor Wedderburn.
Yeah.
And you could get the, you know, the most outstanding scholar in shipping law at University College, and so on. So that was really appealing to me. And the other side of it was the social education. I was a young guy who had been born and raised in Vancouver and had traveled a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but never lived anywhere else. And so to go and live in London was a huge social experience for me. And the program that was offered to master's students, there in those days there weren't very many of us. Today there are quite a few at the University of London at the various colleges. Now the colleges are quite separate and autonomous, but in those days they were all sort of worked together. So the program that was offered gave us an honorary membership at Middle Temple, one of the mm-hmm. inns of court. So the traditions, you were able to go and go have the meals. And so I remember sitting around one night having drinks with Lord Reed, Lord Diplock.
Would you have to wear these formal robes too?
Well, no, just a quick gown.
Okay.
Yeah, just a black gown for the dinners.
Yeah.
I remember I got to know Lord Denning. I would go and sit in his courtroom. And after doing that for some time, I was probably in his courtroom two or three times a week for 3 or 4 months. And then one day his clerk came out and said, basically, are you a law student? I said, yeah, I know. He said, well, Lord Denny would like to meet you. So in I go.
Yeah.
Lord Denny and me, I'm sort of pinching myself.
Yeah.
So I kept going back to his courtroom, and every now and then he'd, you know, call me in and say, you know, what did you think of that? Or, you know, I'm really struggling with this issue. And it was fascinating.
That's incredible. Yeah.
It was fascinating.
Wow.
And then, of course, just the experience of living in London. And, so that was a 12-month program, and it was an experience of a lifetime. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship. So the Canadian dollar was very strong, the pound was weak, and I lived like a king.
Amazing.
Yeah. Just had a great time. Yeah.
Was it a general master's in law, or was there a specific area that you ended up?
Well, I wanted, I had this idea that, you know, Vancouver was on the ocean, so why didn't I, you know, learn a little bit about shipping law?
Okay, yeah.
So I took maritime law and carriage of goods by sea. So that was kind of the focus, but I did want to study under Professor Wedderburn, company law.
Mm-hmm.
He was then the editor of Gower, and he was the man.
Yeah.
And he was a phenomenal teacher. And he took 4 courses, and then there, the maritime shipping law program also kind of tied into an administrative law program. So I took that as well. The focus, and I came back, and I have not practiced maritime law or shipping law or anything to do with oceans ever.
Yeah. But worth the experience.
It was a great experience. Like... It was a scholarly endeavor. That's what it was. Yeah.
And like you said, you still are in touch with people from that.
Oh, yeah. So. In fact, one of my professors, who I got to know socially when I was there, his son is currently staying at our house.
Oh, wow.
In Vancouver.
Yeah.
Right today. So dad sort of said, hey, my son's coming down. Could you take care of him? And no problem.
So you graduated in 1972 and then did your master's. But you've stayed involved at UBC over the years, serving on the Thunder Bay Council for the athletic department, the Board of Governors, numerous advisory committees. Why is it important to you give so much time to UBC?
Well, UBC is very important to my family. My grandfather was UBC, I think it was 1926 he graduated.
Wow.
My mother was UBC 1941. Uncles, aunts, cousins, sister, brother, me. So the university has played a huge role in educating my family, which has given, education is the most important thing in life, perhaps. And so the university gave us that opportunity. My mother and my uncle, I think, were amongst the first Métis to graduate from the university, way back in the late 30s, early 40s. And my uncle went on to become a physician. I think he was probably the first Métis doctor in the province. So the university has played an enormous role in the life of my family and given us collectively and individually the gift of education. And so to give back is important. And it's payback time.
Yeah.
We got a lot out of the university and we want to give a lot back. And so my family, my sister's been president of the Alumni Association. My sister, brother-in-law, and brother were leads on building the rowing facility out on the Fraser River.
Yeah.
Different projects and donations.
And then outside of the UBC community, you've played a significant role in many of sort of the events that have shaped our province, such as Expo 86, founding the Airport Authority, even being part of the Vancouver Grizzlies and the Rick Hansen Man in Motion Foundation. Do you remember any interesting stories from your involvements with these groups?
How much time have you got?
I know.
I mean, Expo changed this city and this province. It was huge. I was late 30s, I think, lawyer with my own little firm. And I was appointed to the board of directors of Expo 86 Corporation by the prime minister of the day. And so it was like, wow. And Jimmy Pattison was the chair of the board of directors, and the other directors were the captains of industry of Vancouver. It was like Bentalls and Keevils and Bentleys and, you know, the captains of it, and then this little lawyer guy. So the experiences there were, it was hard. It was a big gamble that the people of British Columbia took. It was a huge investment. And we had the responsibility to oversee that whole program. Anything went wrong, you heard about it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, a tap on the shoulder. It was a front page story.
In the Sun. Province.
So it was like, and there were lots of issues. Lots of issues. But experiences, fun experiences, met and spent some time with the Prince and Princess of Wales. They opened the Expo. George Bush the First, Margaret Thatcher. I mean, all the world, all many, many world leaders and entertainers. They all sort of went through Expo, and the board of directors was quite small. It was maybe there may be 12 of us, and so we all were trotted out to meet all these folks. So fascinating. I mean, the King of Tonga. He sat and had lunch with the King of Tonga. You know, just experience of a lifetime. Fabulous experience. And then Expo turned out, you know, things went pretty well. And exceeded everybody's expectations. And certainly those people that, you know, put themselves on the line were, you know, given a good pat in the back. And so, you know, I think that was probably one of the experiences that sort of turned the page for me. Mm-hmm. And then the Airport Authority, that again was another one of those lifetime experiences where a relatively small group of us locals who all knew and were either friends or on friendly terms, had an idea. And we were, you know, was becoming very aware that communications, you know, by air, sea, and land was absolutely vital to the success of this part of Canada. These were sort of national assets in British Columbia. The airport was falling way behind, and it was simply a function of politics. And in those days, the Transport Canada ran everything, and if there was a cabinet minister from, you know, Regina, and Regina wanted a runway, but they didn't really need it, they got a runway.
Yeah.
If there wasn't a cabinet minister from Vancouver, and in those days there weren't very many, it was mostly a liberal, political, it was all political.
Yeah.
So there weren't many members of the government of the day that were from here, just the way politics worked at the time. And so the airport was falling way behind, and the capacity just couldn't manage the capacity. And so a small group of us got together with an idea and some very strong political leadership, both provincially and federally. And we put together this proposal to devolve the airport to a local authority. And this was, you know, put together from here.
Yeah.
And so this, I was a lawyer.
Almost completely new.
I was a lawyer guy.
Figuring out how to do it.
And it was like, how are we going to do this?
Structure and, how do we make it legal? How do oh wow.
And what vehicle do you use? And should we make it into a public company and trade shares on the stock market? Should we, you know, you look up, is a partnership? Should we you know, sell to Li Ka-shing? Should we? So we had this group of us took this process through from 1987, sort of following Expo. It's like, what's next?
Yeah.
And we were enjoying this sort of post-Expo success with really no airport. And
you're missing out on business because people can't fly here, and you're missing out on
It was embarrassing. So, you know, frankly, the bureaucrats in Transport Canada didn't think this was a very good idea.
Of course.
And so we negotiated from the sort of late 80s through to the early 90s as volunteers. We were all volunteers. And we negotiated the deal and the transfer and the lease and put in place what is today viewed as one of our, you know, the great successes of this part of Canada. It's, you know, Vancouver, from the Vancouver
airport
model, the model that, you know, some young lawyer guy, kind of dreamed up with the help of a bunch of others. The same model was adopted in Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Toronto, where it hasn't been all that successful, but that's not the fault of the model. It's the fault of local politics, unfortunately. Montreal, Moncton, anyway, a lot of these spread across the country. So that was fascinating. And then watching how this model has worked, and you know, it had to be financeable. You had to go into the markets without a guarantee from anybody, without a balance sheet, and borrow zillions and zillions of dollars. And so the model worked, and it continues to work today. So that's very rewarding. That's sort of one of those fun things that you can look back on and say, you know, that was an idea that a bunch of us came up with, and look where we are. Rick Hansen's one of my closest friends. He came back from his world tour, and he saw an opportunity to take what he'd done and make a bigger difference. Huge obstacles and barriers, but he's a guy that has a dream, and you know, lead follower, get out of the way, because here comes Rick. Amazing. And so I have played very much a supporting role there. I've been on his board ever since, and served as his chair now for a long time. Actually, I've initiated a succession plan, because it's time for somebody else. You know, new blood.
Yeah, you want.
You want new people always. So that's underway right now. But that has been I'm putting it in the category of a passion of mine, and I've supported Rick not only in his endeavors to make material changes to the lives of disabled people, but he's also been an inspiration for all of us, and you know, kids included, mostly. Yeah. So school programs, and you know, you can point to some guy in a wheelchair and say, if he can do that, you little Johnny can, you know, get your math done, or you can, you know, get out there, play that soccer game again. You know, you played badly, and now, you know, work at it.
Yeah.
And it's been a great inspiration. So I've thoroughly enjoyed that. We talked about the Tunisian Consul General.
Yes, that's right.
And that has been a fascinating experience. I've been doing that for some time. And
does that, just to sort of understand, does that mean that you represent sort of Tunisia's legal interests in Canada?
In British Columbia.
In British Columbia,
an ambassador in Ottawa. Yeah. And then there's a Consul General in Montreal. It's a big Tunisian population in Montreal.
It's the French-speaking.
There's one in Toronto, and then there's me.
Yes.
And so Tunisia was where the Arab Spring started, and it has been, I believe it's the only one of the Arab countries that went through that where the democratic process has prevailed. Yeah. So there's now a constitution, there are free elections, and I've had the opportunity to watch all this. It's literally the birth of a democracy. And for someone who is involved in politics, as I am, and law, and has a strong interest in constitutional law, this has been just a fascinating experience. And then, as we talked about earlier, the Tunisian Quartet was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last year. So it's been a great experience. Vancouver Grizzlies, well, that too was a great experience.
Okay.
I was on their board, did all the legal work.
Courtside seats?
Yes. But I paid for them.
Okay.
And they weren't cheap. And that's, it wasn't. The question wasn't, would you like courtside seats? The question was, how many do you want?
Oh, yeah.
And they were expensive.
You were an honorary captain of Canada Fleet Pacific for the Canadian Navy as well, and serve as the provincial chair for the Canadian Forces Liaison Council.
Two great honors.
Is there a military history in your family? How did you end up?
Yes. You know, going back to my grandparents, First World War, you know, grandfather, uncles, and so on, everybody signed up. Mm-hmm. And when the war was over, they came home. So no military careers. Second World War, same thing. The whole family signed up. And when it was over, they all stepped down. So nobody made a career in the military. But it certainly instilled in me a respect for the role the military plays in our democracy. And so my involvement originated through just a general interest in supporting the Canadian forces. I guess it would have been about mid-1990s. The frigate class ships were commissioned, and one of them was HMCS Vancouver. And HMCS Calgary had been commissioned, and the City of Calgary and the Chamber of Commerce and so on, it all got behind the ship. And all of the sailors had cowboy hats, and they named the different parts of the ship after different neighborhoods in Calgary and so on. And so I thought, you know, Vancouver, we're a port town. We should, you know, we got HMCS Vancouver. Why don't we do the same thing?
Yeah.
So I started the Friends of HMCS Vancouver, just a bunch of my friends who, you know, were interested too. And so that organization flourishes today. There's hundreds of people who support it. And then through that, I met the leadership of the Navy. And from that, I was asked to do a few things, which I did. Us as a volunteer. And then one day the Admiral said, would you consider being the honorary captain of the fleet? And a great honor, but, you know, a job.
Yeah.
A volunteer job. And there's lots of stuff to do. But
what kind of duties did you have?
The Navy... the culture of the Navy, and I would suggest the Canadian Forces, but certainly the Navy, is internally focused on being the best Navy they can be. The relationship between the Navy and the community, it's not their culture.
Yeah.
It's not what they do. You know, a ship is deployed, and they're over the horizon, and you never see them for 6 months. You don't know where they are, you don't know what they're doing. And so one of the jobs of the captain is, our captain of the fleet, is to communicate the Navy's message, particularly to decision makers.
Yeah.
But my focus was particularly on the political side and on the business side. So I'm very involved in the Vancouver Board of Trade, yeah. I'm involved in BC Business Council, et cetera, et cetera. So I would, I developed a program of basically communications. And then the role of the honorary captain also is to preserve the history and the lore of the Navy. So I would organize mess dinners very involved with the cadet corps, and you know, you go and you're a captain, and that's, you know, next to an admiral, so you're right up there at the top. And so you would take the salutes and play a real active role in educating young naval personnel and cadets on Navy history and the lore of the Navy and the traditions of the Navy. So between those two responsibilities, and then I've met the most wonderful people. The Canadians that serve are just superior people. It's an honor to associate with them. And then Vancouver, you know, we don't have a base here.
Right, yeah.
So we have some reserve units, the Seaforths and the DCERs and HMCS Discovery, but you don't see people in uniform walking down the street every day.
Yeah.
And so out of sight, out of mind. So it's a kind of a reminder.
You've been recognized for your service with numerous awards, including the Commonwealth Medal for both the Queen's Golden Jubilee and the Queen's Diamond Jubilee.
Yeah.
What's it like receiving recognition for all your service?
Surprising.
Yeah.
I don't do it for the recognition. In fact, I don't like the notoriety around it, but I don't dislike it, I should say that. I'm greatly honored by it, but it is surprising. Because what I do, I just do, and it's just part of, you know, I get up in the morning and that's just part of me, and all of a sudden somebody says that's worthy of recognition. Particularly lawyers, you know, we are in a very privileged position.
Yeah.
And we come out of law school with this great education, and we're trained, you know, we, by and large, you know, live a pretty good life through laws, rewards us materially quite well, you know, so we all live in nice houses and so on, and there's a big payback, and there's a responsibility to get out in the community, and you know, that community that gave you those privileges deserves to have you repay to the extent that you can. So that's basically been my approach. And the you know, the recognition from the Navy, the recognition from the government of Tunisia, the Lions Club International gave me an award, which is the highest award they give to non-Lions, citizenship award.
Wow.
And there was a banquet of a couple hundred people, and I'm sort of like, holy moly, you know. So those are surprises.
Considering your career, you spoke about having a lot of colleagues from law school that you still keep in touch with, but have you met any lawyers or students on your way through your career?
Oh God, yes, many, many, many. Got to know lawyers, two prime ministers very well, Brian Mulroney and Kim Campbell. And Kim and I went to Point Grey together. We were, so I've known Kim, and she did a, when I was doing my master's in law, she was doing a master's in Russian studies in London.
Yeah.
And so we hung out together and sort of pal around. So a lot of politicians, business leaders, gosh, Ross Beaty, Ron Stern. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing how many people you run into that have a law degree and enjoy a successful career in business.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of.
Which accomplishments in your career would you say you're most proud of?
Well, we've talked about a few. I think Expo was sort of the first one. Then putting together the airport, which was interesting. The Grizzlies were certainly interesting. Rick Hansen, fascinating. Honorary Consul of Tunisia. Serving on the International Joint Commission was a real privilege. That's the body of three Canadians, three Americans are appointed by their leader. So it's a prime ministerial appointment and a presidential appointment. And those six manage the Boundary Waters Treaty, which is the treaty between Canada and the United States dealing with the water issues between the two countries. And that includes the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River and all of the rivers and streams and so on that flow back and forth across the border. And there are lots of them, and
yeah,
there's no shortage of issues. And water is very, very, very important. So I got to see, and that was a diplomatic appointment as well. So spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., met fascinating people, served on the board with Pierre Trepanier of the law firm of Hayden, Blakey, Johnson, and Trepanier. Hayden Blakey disappeared about a year ago, but he was one of the founders. And Herb Gray, who was a deputy, longtime deputy prime minister of Canada, and me, three Canadians. And the Americans, one was the former governor of North Dakota, one was the former mayor of Albany, New York, and the third one was a former senator from Illinois. And so the six of us managed, so you know, the experience there was just fascinating. And then served on the board of the Port of Vancouver. Did that for, I was on the board of the port at the same time I was on the board of the airport. And another idea, it was like, why doesn't the port and the airport, can we talk and kind of work together? Because there's a lot of synergy there.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of, not the same network, but there's a lot of overlap. And, you know, that was sort of a common sense thought. And out of that grew the Gateway, which is today an organization of the communications, water transport, the Port of Vancouver, the airport, the other airports in British Columbia, Port of Prince Rupert, and they all get together and work on common projects. So I did that at the same time, and that was sort of part of the initiative that got that going. And then I was chair at Canada Place, and had the experience of winding up a Federal Crown Corporation, which is an interesting experience. So I'm, as chair, I moved Canada Place Corporation into the Port of Vancouver, and I was on the board of the port at the time. So
that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, and that's the way it is today. Yeah. It works very well. So those would be then career. You know, I've been.
When you hung out your own shingle.
I got my own shingle. Yeah. That was a big one. And joining this firm and Clark Wilson at a time when there was a leadership change. The founders had passed on, and the founders of this firm were military men, General Clark, Brigadier Wilson. They were the founders of the Seaforth Highlanders, the regiment, and where the General Clark was the commanding officer of the Seaforth at Vimy Ridge. So a great history, but they were all gone. And by and large, the people that the, you know, like a general officer, you don't need a lot of leaders when you've got a general as your senior partner. So frankly, they didn't attract leaders, and the firm was kind of in decline, but great clients. Firms, well, today it's about 114 years old, so
yeah.
Going way back into the early part of the last century. And deep roots in the community, and sort of everything was all there. And frankly, a bunch of young guys, gals, kind of stepped up and said, let's take this thing to the next level. And we reorganized the firm, and have watched it grow and prosper ever since. So my role in the building this firm is, in my private practice, it's been huge. I command a very large commercial practice. So got to know some fascinating people. My friends and my clients to a large extent overlap. You know, somebody who is successful in business by and large isn't stupid, and by and large has interests, by and large have ideas, they do things, that's kind of a good friend to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my social network and my professional network overlap a lot. Wow. And that has been a source of, great joy and huge reward. Yeah. Watch the profession change. Again, when I first started, there were very few women. Mm-hmm. Very few women. As more women were introduced into the profession, things had to change. And so, certainly this firm has, I believe, been a leader in those changes that have taken place. And I think we're attracting the best and the brightest, men and women, both. So that's probably the biggest change that I've seen from the time I first started practice until today is women in the profession. Still struggling, a lot of issues, but we've come a long, long way. In the community, I've also been very involved politically, and still am. And I've done just about everything in the political world that you can do, short of actually running as a candidate myself. And so I'm continuing to have that involvement, and I think that involvement is very important for our democracy. You know, more people should be doing it, and I would call on young lawyers to play a role there. It doesn't matter what political party or what your cause is, but our democracy survives on people volunteering to support their values.
Yeah.
And so I do that a lot. And I've done everything that a political guy can do.
Do you have any other advice you'd want to share for law students who might listen to this interview?
Well, just the issue of the payback and how we're privileged. And we have the unique ability to do things that non-lawyers don't know how to do, aren't trained to do, won't do, can't do. So I would say that each of us has a responsibility to our community, and I would live up to that. Life balance in private practice, which is all I've ever done, you have to service your clients, and it's very much a service industry. And if you don't service the client, the person down the street's gonna service the client. So you got to be there, which means, generally to a certain extent, your time is not your own. You are in a service industry. You've got to maintain your skill set. That is job one. If you don't have your skill set current and continually updating it, and it's a lifelong learning process, which is something I frankly really enjoy. But you've got to engage in that. You've got to participate in firm management. You've got to go out and get new clients. You've got to deal with the business side of law. You've got to get your billings out. You've got to get paid. You've got to and you've got to keep yourself current, and you've got to mentor and train young lawyers. And somewhere in there, you've got to have the time for yourself and your family. And so it's life balance. And it's not a 100-yard dash, it's a marathon. And it's just something you do every day. You get out of bed in the morning and you get dressed and you got to do all those things. But at the end of the day, you've got that balance. Maintain your standards, your ethical standards. There will be times when it's easier to turn a blind eye, to maybe ignore something or think you can get away with it. Again, it's a marathon, and reputation in this business is everything. Mm-hmm. And can sell your reputation, but you can't buy it. And in the profession, you know who's cuts corners.
Yeah.
And so reputation, maintain your standards. Don't compromise your standards. Keep your skill sets current. It's a big job.
Is there anything else you'd like to share? That was pretty, covered a lot of advice there. So
I don't like
great.
Lawyer jokes. So, yeah. And I don't encourage my friends to tell them. And I don't encourage young lawyers to tell them. I think it diminishes us unnecessarily. So some of them are pretty good. They're harmless, but some of them aren't.
Yeah. Don't tell lawyer jokes. Thank you very much for being part of the interview today.
And good,
for
great.
Participating in the history
I'm glad
project.
We're doing this. 15 minutes ago, I was you. And then just like that.
It's going to go by. Oh,
gosh, it goes by. So, been at the bar since 1974.
Wow. That's a long and you've got time. So many stories to tell for it, though.
I've had a fabulous career. I love what I do. I'm very lucky.